the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hi, Mike.
Ladies and gentlemen, Scott is back.
Hey, yay!
And across the table, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hi, Mike.
Andrew is back with us today. And next to him, we've got Rob Arbatier.
Hello, Mike.
And Martin and Bobby are not with us today. This is an English
show. Hello, Mike.
Show.
Wow.
So I don't know what that means.
It's this side of the pond, eh?
That's right. I got nothing, guys.
You got nothing?
All right, so we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yeah. So if you have any questions or comments, what's that email address?
That's right. No, we were trying to work a guest for today that kind of fell through, but I think we've got a few things we can talk about.
Let's talk about them.
Be pretty interesting.
Isn't that what we do when a guest falls through?
There you go.
Spend the hour ragging on them?
Unless you're going to reschedule them.
Oh, yeah, there is that. There is that.
One thing I wanted to talk about, Andrew, welcome back.
You know,
we've had a couple, topics that I'd like to get, your perspective on. And one was, last podcast, we talked about the Bohemian Rhapsody, the multitracks that are out there on the internet. And, I've actually heard them and I think they were the stems for the 5-1 remix or something like that. Anyhow, they got out. They're on the net. A lot of people have them. So, Andrew and Scott, I know you've also probably had the opportunity to listen to the, Bohemian Rhapsody,
Funnily enough, I have.
Yeah. multi-tracks. And, we had a discussion on our last podcast, about, well, the ethics of it and how we felt about it. Because on one hand, there's a lot of people, if you go on the internet and you go on the boards, you know, you see people that say, hey, what a fantastic, learning tool. And I believe it is a fantastic learning tool. It's kind of cool when you hear some of those tracks solo, but at the same time, it was never meant to be out like that. And let's start with you, Andrew, as a mixer who's worked on some pretty amazing projects. I mean, how would you feel if the raw tracks got out and were floating around on the internet?
I don't know, really. I mean, because part of me thinks, like with anything, it's already been leaked.
Right.
So you could make the argument, well, I'm not doing any extra harm by having it, even though you're not supposed to have it. But that's like keeping stolen goods because they've already been stolen, and that's not cool. But, of course, we're talking about something. It's weird because it can be replicated. It's not like you've got the copy.
Right.
You just have a copy of it, and there can be infinite copies of it. So it's a little weird for that. I mean, obviously, as an engineer, I'd love it because it exists. But it's also it's hard to figure out exactly what it is because the way the tracks are arranged, it sounds like maybe it's a slave. But then there are also their vocals that aren't on the record that are
right.
on there. There are
right.
extras. There's some guitar bits. But so you don't even really know what you've got. So I don't know even how valid it is as a teaching tool. It's just cool to do it. But it's almost cooler in the way people collect bootlegs than it is as a teaching tool or as a – like you can make up any excuse you want, but it's like the people who collect bootlegs, I think, to like have it. It's like, ooh, I've got that too. And like what else can I get the tracks for?
Yeah, although, boy, as a teaching tool, I would say – if you get the final mix and you get some of these raw tracks and you figure out that, hey, I have to go from here, you know, from one side to the other.
Yes, it depends on what.
But I think, though, a huge thing, especially with tracks from that era, is now everybody records things unprocessed.
Right.
It's very clean recordings, and then you do it all later. So if you got the tracks for a current album – and then the mixes, and you tried to figure out how they got from one point to the other. I think you can actually learn a lot, and there'd be a lot you may not even be able to figure out. Whereas with that, I mean, that's like a friend of mine got to go put up some Sly tapes, some of the 16-track masters, and you put the 16 faders up at zero, and that's the record. It's cut that way, and you've got multiple things on a track, but if the tambourine doesn't need to be loud in the chorus, it's recorded quietly. So even the level of the track is already taken care of. The EQ is taken care of. The effects are printed with the instrument. So it's an amazing thing to be able to hear what they did. You can solo up individual things. But like that argument of, oh, well, you can figure out how they did the mix. Well, I'm sure they spent a long time in the mix, but even that, so much of the work has already been done on the tracks that that's not even that relevant.
Yeah, and was it you that brought up the fact, or was it Bobby, that there's also a lot of outboard gear that you'll never even know that they use, that they could have used.
I think Bobby brought that up, but that's true. But as you listen to the tracks, you can hear there was a lot of processing that went down onto the tracks, and it was common back then to try to make it where the mix was the simplest thing in the world, because if you didn't have automation and it got too complicated, the mix became impossible, so you would just try to cut it. That's one of the things I think I brought up last time. You go back to any of Stevie's old masters from that era, mm-hmm. and basically you put the faders up, and the way Gary O and John Fishbeck and Bob Markoff and Malcolm Cecil, all the engineers from those days, basically you listen to the multitracks, which I've had a chance to do, and the tracks just sound like the record. But I will say, if any of those ever leaked to the internet, you know, there would be a huge investigation and somebody would pay a price. And I think at some point they're going to figure out who leaked this Bohemian Rhapsody.
But it is fascinating from almost a songwriting and a recording of just how the songs went down, how it was layered, how the vocals were the individual parts. I mean, ethically, it's not right. But at the same point, also, you know, it's a song that is such a classic that I don't know. It's kind of like a bonus track. But I think there's some way that Queen should be able to benefit from it.
Well, that's the problem. It's a classic that living people still own and now had stolen.
And I really – I think you could – all right, tell me what you learned then, because I'm not buying that you'd actually learn a lot by studying it. It's cool.
You don't think young music students and young engineers?
Not a thing, because there's nothing in the individual tracks that you can't hear in the mix.
Well, okay, well, I can tell you something. Okay.
Like, what about the vocal doubling?
I would say, I would say to hear an individual track of the vocals by themselves, to hear what that sounds like naked, without all the rest of it, it'll let you know. Hold on, it'll let you know that if you're recording and you can come up to a similar quality or of audio of sound, that hey, this is potential. I mean,
no, I'm not buying it, because that's, you don't have Freddie Mercury in front of the mic. Well, like, if you're recording Freddie Mercury, then absolutely you better make it sound as good as that. But you got to go dig him up and reanimate him for that to happen with him. So
there's instructions for that on the internet too.
Yeah, well, let me ask you though. I think
it is supremely cool. I'm not saying
it
isn't amazing,
and I'm not condoning it and saying everybody should go out and, you know, every music school should have this, but I mean, you remember when you first got started working in music and you're recording things for the first time and you're wondering, man, is this good enough? Is this like the big boys do it? And now you can hear what a soloed big boy sound is like.
Yeah. I mean, I can see that. I don't know that it would, in the actual day to day doing your gig, I don't know how useful it would actually be, but it is great to be able to do it. It is fascinating, but it's like the commentary track on a DVD, and I always wish there was a great way to do that for records.
Right.
And this is one way to do it. It's like, hey, here's the multitrack, figure it out.
About the TV show? I forgot the name of it, where they feature each of
the classic albums.
Yeah, where they say, hey, listen to the vocals. Look, we did this, we did that. And you get to hear each track separate.
Okay, but there's the classic albums of this album, and they talk about this song.
Mm-hmm.
So you should watch that show and let them explain it to you, and they can solo up what they want you to hear, and then...
I would be willing to buy things like this.
Well, it's,
I mean,
fine,
forget about just being free on the internet.
Yeah.
From the ethics, but it'd be just
thing, obviously, it shouldn't have been leaked.
Sure.
Once it's leaked, whatever. I'm not going to sit here and say that you need to avoid it. I can't make that argument.
I understand that, but I just think, like, for instance, the piano, okay? The piano, to me, was just this amazing-sounding piano in the song. And then when you hear it, it sounds raw and naked, and you're like, wow, that's not what I expected, but it's kind of cool to hear
I agree with Andrew. I don't think it's that educational. I think the only part of this that's really educational, from what I heard of the tracks, is to somebody who doesn't have a trained ear for picking apart harmonies, because a lot of people, when you hear all those vocals layered and it turns into a big cluster chord,
right.
a lot of people can't pick apart those notes.
Yeah, to hear their voicings and stuff like that, sure.
To hear the voicings, you can actually see the way they built the chord, and that might actually make you a better vocal arranger, because that is incredibly great vocal arranger.
But you don't think that young college students that are studying music, like, you know, would find the stuff
fascinating?
I don't
think young college students know this song.
Oh, yes, they do. Oh, yes, I've seen Wayne's
World.
But
I'm just talking about, I mean, again, ethics aside, and I agree with that. I think when I was at Berkeley, if I would have had tracks to be able to analyze what they were doing, how they were.
What are you analyzing, though?
You know, I'm analyzing how the arrangements of how they're being put together, what they record. I mean, what I think they may have recorded. I mean, I do agree with Andrew. You don't know the tracks that you're hearing. Were they recorded that way? Were the comps down? What are they? But it's still, I thought it was incredibly fascinating.
Oh, it's fascinating.
You know, ear training, 101 stuff, and.
Yeah.
It's like if you were to see, you know, somehow they were able to go back and the Mona Lisa, you were able to see, like, okay, here's where the red paint went and here's where the blue paint went, and you could see it pulled apart. That would be really cool to know.
For me, as cool as it is to have the multi-track and things like that, I think the classic albums show about the song is worth 100 of that.
No, that's true. I definitely agree.
Because that way, even though you can't, I mean, what I would love is the classic albums. But I get to sit there and ask them the questions, you know, and so yeah. I'll sew it up and say, yeah, so what'd you do here? Yeah.
So it's a new video game with classic albums. We get the multi-track, you get to hear it soloed, and they talk and commentate through it.
Well, I will say that this isn't unique to this. There's a lot of multi-tracks that are out there.
And some of them on purpose. I mean, Nine Inch Nails stuff has been put out multi-track. Right. As a release.
Right. Well, another famous one, and I started doing all this research, especially after the last podcast, and you can just go on and just Google multi-track tapes, and you'll be amazed what'll pop up. Genie in a Bottle, that's out there. That's a pretty recent one. Superstition, that's out there. The multi-tracks are out there. There's Doobie Brothers stuff.
Yeah, we know how that one got out there.
Yes.
Yeah.
It got a little ugly. Let me just put it this way. You don't want to be caught as the guy who let something like that leak. It doesn't work out for you in the end.
Well, without naming names or anything, how did something like that happen? Was it a safety copy? Was somebody going through some archive stuff? Or how does something that...
You know, if you have a long enough career and record enough songs and have enough tapes at enough studios, stuff can get lost. Because especially in the old days where you used to leave your tapes at the studio,
right?
Stuff just happens. And if you have thousands and thousands and literally thousands of multi-track tapes floating around, how hard is it to believe that something's going to get out?
There was a studio. I did a lot of work at Studio 55, which was bulldozed it must be 10 years ago now. But when they bulldozed it, I had been up in the tape library, which was up in the attic space, and they hadn't gotten rid of all the tapes. So they bulldozed it, and there were piles of rubble with Ringo Starr 16-track masters that John Lennon had overdubbed on. I mean,
no.
And they're just in the rubble getting into the dumpsters. So, I mean, obviously, if tapes can be hanging around studios when they're being closed and bulldozed,
yeah.
I mean, if you're an assistant without too much scruples and you start working at a new studio, I mean, it's less likely to happen now because nobody has tape anymore because it's all been gotten rid of.
Right.
And people don't leave their drives there anymore. But if, you know, you're saying they're supposed to be empty in the waste baskets and there's a John Lennon master, you'd put it up on the machine.
Yeah, well, it's just like in movies, you know.
Yeah.
There's a famous dub house that got busted royally in Hollywood because one of the persons that worked there, his apartment was full of those wire racks and had all kinds of clones of masters.
Really?
Yeah.
But I know that, you know, that Gary Rydstrom did a analysis of Jurassic Park track by track, showing what he did, how it was mixed, and it was fascinating how we recorded it, what happened. But I know a lot of times people love to hear the multi-channels of the film stuff because a lot of times a lot of stuff seems like it all fit together, but it was all, you know, 600 tracks.
But, yeah, if a film is 600 tracks, so I'd rather have the guy who did it take me through and show me the cool parts. I mean, having that actual multi-track would be a little daunting.
Well, there is a website, and I think they're going to try to –
Mike's multi-track set.
No, make a buck somehow or get the licensing rights. It's called multitrackclassics.com. You go there right now and there's nothing up there.
Yeah, good luck with that idea. Yeah. Good luck with that.
But I don't know.
The concept is cool. The reality was not as cool as the concept, I think, is would my
you,
take on
it. Now, let me ask you, would you pay money for multitracks? If some famous song, the record label went back in and said, hey, we can get 24 tracks of pick a song, ELO, Mr. Blue Sky, and you can buy that for $25. Would you pay money for a classic track?
Not for that one, no.
See, I would, because that talk about orchestration and stuff, that would be amazing.
I'd be interested to have Jeff Lynne sit and take us through it and
explain how he came up
with some stuff.
I would, because I hoard things. Like, I love collecting stuff, right. And so I probably would, but I don't know.
But
I
could probably do it in Blu-ray.
The thing that's really scary, though, is their albums. I would be more likely to want multi-tracks of albums that I think are really good but were mixed terribly so I could just mix them so I could listen to them. That would be what I would want more than studying stuff that I thought was great.
That is a very unique case.
That's a unique case. But you know what I would do? I would buy those
songs. I'd like to hear your mixes of them.
Exactly.
There'd be a lot of remixes floating around of a lot of stuff if they actually do this, though.
Well, that's one of the things we talked about last time, too. How long is it going to be before you start hearing some of the Bohemian Rhapsody guitar tones
or
samples?
Oh, it has to already be happening.
Yeah.
It has to already be happening.
I just think, it's I can see why they wouldn't want to do it, but I can see it being a really good moneymaker if they could do it. If they could do it, I would absolutely be buying.
Oh, if the people who choose to, if the people who own it choose to sell it, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that at all.
Especially classic tracks. I mean, that would just be a whole nother level of, piracy.
But there's a lot to be said for, the same thing when rough mixes of an album leak. And it's like, well, but that's not how we want people to hear it. And to make it to where everybody gets to decide how they hear it. It's like it's not even a choice of the rough mix or the final mix. It's like, oh, whatever, listen to it however you want.
But see, but that's just it. I think the appeal would be tracks that are already established and already, ingrained in our mind. We already know what Bohemian Rhapsody sounds like. We already know what Superstition sounds like. There's just
live concert bootlegs. It's imperfect and
You can tell a remix of a song just, four notes, boom, that's not the original, especially like a cover band trying to play.
Oh, I don't mean that someone, could start taking business away from the actual mix.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to start selling your mix of Bohemian Rhapsody. But I don't know. It's a really odd thing.
It's weird. It's just.
It really doesn't have to do with the commerce of it, because no one can actually take this multitrack and do anything with it and make any noticeable amount of money without the people who actually own it.
And the weird thing is, I don't even think you could do the equivalent in film. It's the only artistic endeavor that could be done this way. Cause there's no way to split a painting up like this. You could get a film's audio tracks like this, but you can't split the picture back up unless you got every camera angle of every shot and it was shot with multiple cameras and you did your own edit there's no equivalent to this. With a book, you can't do it. So it's such a bizarre thing that you could actually pull it back apart, which you can't do with anything else.
Well, with a book, they're trying to, rewrite some of the Harry Potter. Well, not rewrite. Some fans are writing their own.
But that's not anything like having the multi-track original
that's
Harry Potter book.
Right.
It's like there's no equivalent to it. So I don't even know how to conceptualize it.
Yeah.
Like there's no analogy you can make. It's a bizarre on its own kind of thing.
You know what you can? Gamers with mod kits for computer games, you can reimagine
a video
game.
Yeah, so but it doesn't give you the elements of the original game. It's a different thing, though.
Well, but then actually in film, though, you do if you have the dailies that you can go into. Which is what's happening is there's a lot of remakes. They go back into the film. The director wants to look at Star Wars. Lucas went back in, added a whole bunch more scenes, added CG. We did a lot of the old Star Wars.
But can you – how could all of those elements get out for someone to have?
Well, in the past, it was too big, so it wasn't practical.
You need a couple of trucks.
Yeah. No. You're absolutely right with the way
– or Blu-ray.
Audio is not that big at all. And with high-speed internet and compressed files, boom, you can pretty much pick up any of these multi-tracks.
Yeah.
I guess there could come a time when somebody could download all the dailies for a huge film and edit their own version of it. It's hard to believe, that would ever be a problem.
Well, that's true, too, because you're right. Because there was a time where you were thinking, 24 tracks, and you're thinking these big reels, and how could they ever get out? And here we are.
Well, but there was someone who re-edited one of the newer Star Wars movies just based on the version that was released and re-edited. And there are all these people saying, "Oh God, it was so much better."
That's where they cut out Jar Jar Binks.
It was only 20 minutes long, but
it was really good.
All right. Well, hey, we've spent two podcasts on that.
I believe that horse is dead. And beaten.
But it's really fascinating. I think it's important to have Andrew's opinion on that, especially since
it's so vague and noncommittal.
There was nothing vague about that. I want to move on. I don't know if you guys know this, but Nine Inch Nails released an instrumental album, 36 tracks. You could get tracks 1 through 9, I believe, for free. And then they have about 4 different pricings. You can get 9 tracks for free. You can spend $5 and get the download. $10, you get the 2 CDs. $75 gets you 2 CDs plus a data DVD with the digital tracks. So I don't know if that's multi-track or not.
Probably.
And yeah, coming from Trent. And then, $300 will get you 4 LPs on vinyl, all the other stuff, downloads, 2 prints, a bunch of other stuff. Anyhow.
And for $500, Trent Reznor will come and line your turntable for you.
And there's a limited run of 2,500, $300 sets, and they sold out already. And I just found out about this yesterday, day before.
Yeah.
And I already, I bought the CDs because I just thought it was, it's important to support people that try this kind of stuff. But what was really interesting was there's, 1, 2, 3, 4 different prices. They're coming out at everything from free to, $300. And I don't know if you guys remember, but obviously, I know you did because you bought the album. When Radiohead, when they released their album, they kind of did the same thing.
Yeah. This is the In Rainbows model with more tiers.
But they got, you read in press and they got kind of crucified afterwards, and not really them, but their fans, because, people were saying that, nobody bought the album, and people were talking about how.
More than enough people bought the album for Radiohead, though.
Oh, I would imagine
think they
so.
were thrilled with it.
I can only imagine, and what I want to put out is is this the future? You think more and more artists are going to go independent and start doing this multi-tiered
I think it's exactly what we said when we talked about the Radiohead release when it first happened, is for an established act like that,
right,
especially one that's considered cool, like Radiohead or like Nine Inch Nails, who can do something in an alternative way and the fans actually kind of want to do it because then they're cool too. Absolutely it works, and it's the perfect thing. You have the free version, you have the value-added version. And look at what they're adding. They're adding vinyl. Like, the most expensive way to buy either of those albums is on vinyl.
It's kind of funny.
And it's brilliant, because basically, the more you pay, the better audio you get. And that's the only difference between any of these, is you either get more songs or you get better sounding versions of those songs the more money you spend. And I think it's great. But it's not going to work for new acts ever.
No, it's easy to be successful with this if you're already successful.
So you don't think the new act should come out with multi-tier marketing to say, hey, listen, you can get, 5 songs for $5.
No, because if nobody knows them, everyone's going to take the free option. And who's going to shell out the money?
I don't know. I think it'd be a good way. If I heard 5 tracks and I really like that band, I might go for the next, 20 tracks if they had 25 tracks, or if they give you 3 tracks.
You have to think very differently as a startup, as an independent, because you don't have an existing fan base that's loyal that way, that's going to actually come out of pocket for any of the higher prices. So you can come up with a tier pricing system. You can come up with clever incentives. I forget the name of the artist, but I was just what is her name? There's an artist who I was just told about who has fans donating to the production fund for her album, and she has different levels of membership.
Oh, it's Jane Seabury.
Is that who it is?
Yeah, she goes by a different name now. It's Jane Seabury. She's a Canadian artist who's been around for a long time, and now it's the donation-based recording.
And is she the one who had the song I Kissed a Girl?
That's Jill Sobule.
Yeah, that's who I'm thinking of.
Oh, okay.
So she's already raised, as of today, I think it was $56,000.
Because she wants to go in the studio.
Well, she's doing this independently. She wants to go in the studio, but she has all these different memberships. And I forget what the tiers are, but you know, for $5, you can order an advanced copy of a single. For $10, when the CD's done, you can get a copy. I forget the prices, but, you know, like, for $100, you can sing on the CD, and it doesn't matter if you can't
$100?
Sing.
We're in there for $100.
I just remember, for $5,000, she'll actually come into a concert at your house. And the other thing I remember, the membership names have funny names. Like, for $100, you get, like, a super gold membership or something. And then for $200, it's the same as the $100 membership, but you spend more money. And she has all these different tiers, and it's just hilarious. And she's already raised $56,000, which is not minor. So that's just creative marketing, and creative marketing always works.
$100 to see.
Yeah, I think the key is, though, it's just,
look up her
it has
website.
To be creative and has to go along with your persona as an artist. And
right.
it's going to be different for everybody. But a brand new act, maybe it would work, but the percentage of the people who would get the free thing that then shell out money for the thing that costs money
right.
is very small. And so if it's, let's say it's 2%, I mean, I don't know what the percentage would be, but if it's 2% of several million people, you're doing all right. But if it's 2% of 150 people the first week,
yeah.
don't spend too much time making up the $80, you know, vinyl set.
No, you don't have to worry about that. But coming up with a clever, creative way
because then,
to sell
yeah,
the thing
then
is
people
valid.
Feel like they're part of it. I mean, that was the thing about the Radiohead thing. I felt like I was a part of this
yeah.
release by going and ordering
yeah.
the disc box.
Exactly. When I bought the Nine Inch Nails and also the Radiohead, I felt
and
the
they don't have to sell nearly as many because obviously they have a much larger financial back to it. You know, it's not getting all going to this place and that place and the promotion, distribution, whatever. They are the label. And
yeah.
the fact that they then did a normal CD release is just – that's just icing. And they sort of put their middle tier in late.
Oh, yeah. No, that was brilliant. Well, I'll tell you, on the Nine Inch Nails, it was really painless. Their website was up. It had a fast download. They're shipping the CDs out.
Well, and he tested this with that Saul Williams record that he put out a couple of months ago that Trent produced. And it was the same thing where it was an online-only release and their own label. And it was just like, hey, we finished the record. It's out. It's done. Come to this website.
Yeah. Yesterday, the servers were totally backed up. But I guess overnight they put some more servers up in. Because today when I tried it, it was painless. Downloaded really – I mean, just an amazing speed, you know. Like 3,000K download or something. I mean, just something – ridiculously fast. And by the way, the album is instrumental. It's, you know, a lot of moody, a lot of different kinds of textures. But if you do any type of motion graphics, you want to buy this album because you'll be able to cut like your reel to this thing. You'll be able to, I mean, you're going to see it all over the place. The licensing, they're going to make a mint licensing this thing out. But one reason I wanted to talk about this, I got in a really interesting conversation with a friend of mine, and we were talking about all this independent release, where, you know, more artists are releasing their albums like this using this kind of novel approach. And he was wondering, and I wanted to ask you guys, you know, is this going to wreck the economy of the working engineer, of the working musician? Is it going to – because without the label support, when artists go independent like this, is there going to be a market for mixing engineers the same way and the tracking engineers?
Strangely, I've given this a little bit of thought.
Yeah, I would think
I understand.
But I think it's a two-stage thing. The first stage is what you said, which is absolutely true because record budgets – don't even exist in a lot of cases because the bands are paying to make it themselves. There is no budget. It's, well, I'm going to get $1,000 from my dad and we're going to book this room I can get for $500 a day for 2 days with the engineer who's there. And that guy's not getting paid anything. And so there are going to be fewer and fewer gigs for paid engineers. In terms of the musicians, I don't know as much because I think it's already from years ago, session musicians are playing on a very small subset of the records being made, and those records are still going to be made because it's the big pop productions and things like that. I don't know it's going to cut into them as specifically. But in terms of engineers, absolutely. And what's going to happen is, like with all of the little indie unsigned stuff that I do, the deals are – it used to be, hey, man, we got like $700 a track or something like that. Can you produce this and, you know, we'll use your studio and it'll be doing that. And now – there's no money up front, And they just make you some version of basically a band member. So I'll produce an album for a band now. There's no money up front. We use my studio, so I have all the outlay. But, you know, it's a studio that I've already built. And in exchange for that, I have a piece of everything. It's like a 360 deal that the labels are trying to cut. But
right.
It's cut very specifically for the person working on the record. Where, all right, you've got some publishing, you've got some merchandise, you've got some whatever. And it may or may not amount to anything. But it's a lot better than taking almost no cash at all and being done. Or like, oh, give me a point. Because they know they can't sell this stuff. I mean, they're going to bring the CDs to gigs. But half the time, I'm even telling the bands, look, just give the CDs away, man. That's how people are going to hear it and be into it and whatever, especially if you're not the headlining band at the club. Just give them away. Everybody goes home and they like the show and then they listen to the CD and they remember you and then they'll find a way to spend some money on you at some point. And so that, I think, is the future of most, not the top tier, because there will always be some records with budgets.
Right.
You know, the top of the R&B, the top of the pop thing, there'll be some money. But for, especially for just for rock bands, I think that's the way it's going, is the engineers can't get paid the way we're used to getting paid, which is you make this much an hour to
right,
go record
exactly.
some stuff. You're just going to have to be part of the back end in some way. Or bands are just doing it on their own. There is no engineer on a lot of these records.
Yeah, that's
That's not a good thing. And sonically, it's not a good thing a lot of the time.
It's just, I mean, yeah. If you're in recording school right now, it's
all right. Well, here is a here's a case in point about recording schools. So UCLA
right.
Extension, right. I teach a class there, and they have for years they have certificate programs. So that's just the normal sort of continuing education degree
sure.
programs, and they've got lots of them in film for acting or producing or cameraman and all kinds of stuff in film. And they've had one in music recording for years and years and years. Last year, they got rid of the certificate program because it required too many practical classes where you would actually go to a studio and do stuff. And those classes were expensive and people weren't signing up for them. So now there's no recording certificate. They've redone all of their certificates. There's only one that's even in music anymore, and it's in film scoring. And the recording classes aren't even listed as electives anymore. So they've basically taken their entire recording school and just said, there's nobody signing up. Nobody cares. There's no point.
Wow.
And they did it completely by necessity. They wanted to have this recording certificate. They loved the fact that they had it because, I mean, being in LA and UCLA,
yeah.
the people you could get to teach these
Absolutely.
Things, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And nobody could sign. No one signed up anymore.
So you're not teaching?
Well, I'm supposed to start teaching a class at the end of March, and so far no one's enrolled, and there may not be enough people enrolled to run the class because
wow.
there's no point in them taking the class other than the class itself. It's not towards anything. It
sure.
doesn't help them. It won't even help them as an elective in one of their film certificates.
You know what I think? I think Andrew needs a hug.
I'm screwed, but
no,
I'm happy.
No.
You know.
He's screwed, but
that's terrible.
It's
that's really
it
depressing.
Was really bad.
Wow.
It's like having a party. Nobody should.
Wow.
Yeah.
That means, you know, our seven listeners are going to go down to five.
Well, so, I mean, I don't know what's happening with places like Full Sail or, you know, I know the, what's the one that's got schools all over the country? There's one of those recording schools.
Oh, SAE. And
yeah, or something like that. They've got tons of branches and they're still opening them. And I don't know because I think there are still lots of younger kids coming up. And, you know, you get excited about – no one gets excited about being an engineer other than they're excited about music and that's the way they decide they want to be a part of making records.
Yeah.
That's
you know?
The thing. I think, you know, like at Berkeley, there used to be the engineering program and music technology, and those two, I mean, it's all the same thing.
Yeah, well, in Miami was the same way. I have a degree in music, but it was a specialty in recording. So I think there are always going to be people who want to do it, but there's no money in teaching it because there's no money in doing it in general. I mean, there are still lots of engineers getting paid, but
I wonder if the money, though, is in teaching people the tools in like 3-day seminars on Pro Tools or
well, that's
or
the thing
week,
is all
kind
of the classes they're still running are for home production, and they were thinking about having a home music production certificate program
right.
as opposed to a studio one. But the thing is, like last time I taught this class, I started teaching one day analog tape, and I got about 5 minutes in, and I just thought, I am wasting your guys' time. We're going to skip this, and I'm going to show you some editing stuff in Pro Tools instead. Because it was a total waste of time, talking about magnetic flux. And what are you kidding me?
See, why couldn't you be like that? Why couldn't I have my English lit teacher be like that?
Well, because those books are actually very good, and you should reread them now.
We're not going to read.
You were a little young for Hemingway at that point.
A gerund.
But it's true. I mean, to teach people to record in studios at this point it's irrelevant. I mean, I feel even more strongly that you really need to know about recording and acoustics because you're recording in horrible places, and you have to make up for a lot of stuff. As opposed to if you go into a good studio with good mics, you can be an idiot and get good sounds on stuff. You can roll a microphone in on the floor and it's going to sound all right. But when you're in, your buddy's bedroom trying to record drums on three mics that all have USB outputs, well, if you know a little bit about recording, you can make it work. But it doesn't mean people are going to pay money to learn it.
Well, hey, we're gonna take a break right now because I'm depressed. but we'll come back and we'll finish this discussion. We'll see you on the other side.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, Andrew basically depressed everybody in the room.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, well.
The outlook for engineers
it's what
is
I
just
do.
Crap.
It's my thing.
It's your thing.
I think it's really important because especially a lot of people who are listening to the podcast, are in school or want to be an engineer, and it's just a different time.
Well, I mean, the thing that I've always said to the classes and also to anybody, you work at a studio and there's an assistant, you start talking, whatever. And it's like the only reason you do this, recording music, is because you can't possibly do anything else. I mean, and that was true even when there was work and money. Like, don't go into this for the glamour. Do it because you absolutely couldn't possibly do anything else. And it's just more true now. It's not different. It's just a little, the reward is going to be a little less than it might have been a few years ago.
It's funny you say that because I was reading online in one of the Yahoo articles or something like that, and it was talking about, the next great, opportunities in show business. And one of the things they were talking about was an engineer, an audio engineer. But I think actually that was more post than music, because I think post, there's tons of opportunities.
Yeah, at least. Absolutely. I mean, and it's been happening for years where fewer people are asked to do a larger chunk of the show because the technology allows them to do a bit more faster. I mean, it's not like the guy who was in here talking about cutting mag on the cartoons.
Yeah.
I mean,
Tom.
But still,
Tom Gleason.
You got to have somebody do it. Where I don't, but then there are filmmakers who are just doing it themselves.
Right? I mean, actually, where the big opportunities now is in gaming.
Yeah, no, gaming.
They are hiring them by hordes. I mean, EA, Ubisoft. I mean, these people
sound
are
designers hiring, or mixers.
It's
or?
All the same thing. It's not like these only mix.
Sure,
the sound designers, this integration, composers, more music opportunities now in gaming, but the bar is rising really high. I mean, right now, I've just got a game that is now paying more than another movie I'm trying to get. Twice as much a game. It's, your games now are $30 million to make one game. It's no longer this $2 million thing. But the problem is you've got John Debney. You've got
all the out of work film composers.
You've got Danny Elfman's doing it.
Wow.
And a lot of times I'm not sure if they're actually doing it or their guys are doing it. I mean, I can't say for sure.
But that's true with the films,
well,
too.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Let's
Hans Zimmer School of Music,
Let's segue to talk about gaming for a little bit because, number one, it's going to fill some time because, like I said, I've got nothing. And number two, Scott, I do know last week you had your conference for the organization that you're involved with.
Well,
and a lot of people were talking about it. I will tell you that I've had friends that, you know, they don't know that I know you. They were talking about the conference and asking if I was going to go, and I mean, unfortunately couldn't
make it. The Computer Game Developers Conference took over two of the big halls at Moscone Center. It was bigger than AES. And there were a lot of people, everything from graphic artists to audio people to gaming people to technology people.
Yeah, but didn't you have
we also had there was also ISD event. We had
last week in Hollywood, right?
Yes, that was there's a tool set called FMOD. Think of it like Pro Tools. And like Digital Performer, there's two tools out there called Weiss and FMOD. And these are multi-platform tool sets. They'll work on PS3, 360, Wii, whatever. And they were showing off FMOD over at a place called RSPE. And Weiss is going to do a world tour with ISD, as so is FMOD again. It's great. We did a multi-city tour. We did L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, and Vancouver. And we did it over a one-week period. And it was great. We had probably about 40 to 50 members in each place show up in each city.
And you just demoed it?
Yeah, they showed it off for about an hour and a half, the tool sets and how it's used. And
really quick, just so you can give people an idea, what does the tool set do? Give us a thumbnail description.
On the music side, they had an interactive music section where you can take different pieces of music. It's kind of Ableton Live meets a computer program. You can do scripting in it. You can change tempos. You can
Flash for audio?
No. You could then do subsets of emotions, so you can say these sets of cues can randomize because it's not always going to play the same. So it's like it reminds me of old sequencer technology where you can make arrangements and then arrange them in different patterns. And then if you want to get even crazier, you can do multi-track. So you can say each track has, let's say, six tracks. And then you can use any of those six tracks, and that will go for, 16 measures.
So I'm confused. So it's like an organizational and control system. They can take all these elements and control the way they're used during the game?
Yes, based on emotions. Are you winning? Are you losing? Are you winning for the second time? How fast are you going through the game?
And if you tell this engine we're winning, then you can tell it what to do to all the different audio tracks and sounds.
Right, and also has beat markers to sit there, and it automatically knows what tempo you're at. So as it goes from cue to cue, it can automatically go to a different cue at that same tempo. And you can then put stingers in, you can put different melodies in.
And does the composer or sound designer use the system when they're creating the stuff, or is it put in there later to integrate it all?
The composer composes the building blocks that a person who is the mixer or integrator can then put those together in a way, can do volume issues. There's a lot of parameters that can be adjusted, as well as the whole sound effect side. Is, when you shoot a gun, it's not always the same gun. It can randomize between different samples. Not only that, but the way they do guns now, if you're doing a gun, I may have the gunshot, the mechanism, and then there'll be a report. And you may record the gun at four different places downrange up to half a mile away. So as that player comes running at you, it's going to crossfade between all those different gun elements until it comes to you.
That's amazing.
So because the audio for the game is mixed in real time as you play the game,
yes.
The job of the integrator or mixer, it's actually a dual job because he's figuring out how the mix conceptually is going to come together, but he's not then locking down an exact mix. He's just saying how the elements are going to interact.
What I like to break it in, using my own terminology at our company, I look at integration into two aspects. There's sound design integration, and that's creating sound design using multiple elements within the game to ascertain any given sound. And then there's the mix integration, which says, okay, I've got all of these 100 things playing at once. How should it happen? It can be done by priorities. It could be done by drop the sound that has the lowest volume, drop it. You're not going to hear it. It could be based on range within the game. It could be that as you move within a distance pattern, you can start put a low pass in there.
Does one person make these decisions, how the stuff gets integrated? Is that person a mixer? Or?
Yeah, does it ever – do you ever do this real time? Do you ever like –
It's usually the audio director or sound designer, the main lead person.
But it's a technical job, right? I mean,
it's an object-oriented. It's all graphics. It's like, do you need an engineer to run Pro Tools?
Yes.
Not always.
I mean, as a player, writer, you end up using Cubase
yourself. You don't need to have an operator.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're your own operator.
Absolutely. You just
answered
the question.
But there has to be someone who has – I mean, it's a – you can't learn Pro Tools overnight, and I'm sure you can't learn this.
I know, but you
got to
remember, people
overnight.
That are on games aren't for a year. And not only that, they have their own technology departments making – this is called middleware. Most companies have their own proprietary software that – like EA only uses their software. And they've got companies doing their own plugins. So making their own EQs, making their own reverb settings – they're talking to a lot of other companies about doing it, but they have to have some small CPU footprints, memory footprints, et cetera, et cetera.
How do you get into that? If somebody wanted to get into being an integrator.
Yeah, because I'm going to need a job.
The best way, most people that I know, I met a guy who was a game tester, and now he's running all of the production at one of the major studios. And a lot of times you get kids either in high school or college.
But Vinandra's not going to be a tester. I've seen him play video games.
A game tester.
But you know what's interesting is, even for somebody like Andrew,
most of the scores now are using live orchestras. This whole bit, I mean, it used to be that one or two of them. Right now for the Gang Awards, when I was judging the music side of it.
Right.
Everything was orchestras. They're using Abbey Road. They're using Seattle. They're going to Budapest. I mean, they're using massive choirs. It's the real thing. I mean, a lot of times, a lot of the game companies, one game company said that if you haven't done TV or a movie, you're not going to do the music for our game. It's no longer the kid out of college
right.
who's got a little bit of talent. It's not, I mean, it's almost, it's not quite as hard as doing movies. But it's serious.
Now, but if there was a person, let's say you know Pro Tools, if you've mixed post-production or film or whatever, and you wanted to get into gaming, would EA hire an audio engineer
I'd say the doors, what you do is like in any business, you find someone who's in that business, you become a friend, you find an opportunity and an opening, they like what you did, and they hire you. I mean, I thought a great one was BioShock. And Emily was the audio director and sound designer. She hired the composer, and he was a TV composer. And from what I had heard, he was doing pretty much commercial stuff. She didn't hire him on his reel. She hired him they liked the same kind of music, though none of them had the opportunity to do that kind of music because TV would be too weird. So she loved that this guy really was thinking outside the box. He did the music for it, and it won so many awards that he got a chance to be creative in a very non-commercial way.
Right.
And I think that some of the coolest things that I think about game music is that it's probably more innovative than TV and film.
That's probably true because you have a bunch of different emotions and a bunch of different
versions. And people thinking weird. They're thinking outside the box. I mean,
now, but let me ask you. You haven't answered the question.
Oh, okay. How do you get into the business?
Like we know the composers and the music side, but what if somebody wants to be a mixer or a facilitator or whatever you call it? Do they come in through sound design? Do they come in as a, hey, this guy's mixed before and now we can put him into this?
No. What you do is, you find somebody at the game studio. I'll give you an idea. At the Computer Game Developers Conference, they have a hall looking for jobs. Every company has a booth with headhunters. I mean, where have you seen that in the music business where they're all like, EA's got six guys looking for people.
Right.
They are constantly looking for young talent or new talent. And, they have job fairs, massive job fairs, whether they're looking for programmers, 3D artists, music composers, whatever.
But will they?
And then you interview.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, do they hire them into that position so someone can be hired into doing a facilitator?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what level you're at. If you want to be a composer or be in the audience,
I'm just talking about pure engineering, pure.
But it doesn't. It's a different paradigm.
Okay, so there is no pure engineering.
I mean, engineer meaning grab a mixing console. No, the mixing console doesn't exist.
Okay, that's one question that's answered. There is no mixing console. The next thing is. Do you have to do sound design or music, or can you be just somebody who knows how to place things really well and knows how to work with all these elements? Is there that programmer position that's available?
Well, I think that it's not – you have to use a different paradigm, and that is – okay, in a game, they'll hire a composer.
Right.
Okay. The composer will have his crew of people to create music for that project.
Okay.
Most likely, they will have the composer, an arranger – an engineer, and a handful of musicians that they like to use. Very similar to be honest, like TV and movies. So if you want to get into the, I want to engineer music for games, find a composer.
Okay.
The composer is the one that's hired. Same thing with movies.
What about sound effects?
Okay. Sound effects, you're either in-house or you're being a third party like Soundelux, Technicolor.
Right.
And then you have to join those crews. If you're a young sound – see, the problem with us, we have to guarantee the client a very high-end product.
Right.
There's not a lot of ability for somebody to come into a company like ours to learn.
Okay.
Because, you know, I need to pay you a lot of money for doing what? I need you to design. If you don't have to design, I don't know – there's not a lot of jobs open. At the studios, you might be doing dialogue. You might be – around, you might be a game tester.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of little things that need to go on.
It doesn't sound
on.
Like anyone starts as an integrator.
That's basically.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, nobody. Integration is the highest level.
Okay, so then.
It's a combination of mixer, producer. Whoever's going to control the soundtrack is the integrator.
That's what I wanted to know. So basically, Andrew.
Yeah, I'm screwed.
You know, it's learning a different tool set. A lot of times I'm hired to consult. As integration, they'll get someone who knows the program really well, and I'll sit with them, and I will give them my flavor of taste of how I think it should sound.
Well, you know, that's really fascinating is just how it's the paradigm in games is so different because sound is so important in games, and yet it's so foreign to how we're used to working on films and music and TV and things like that.
But you know what?
It's actually
the
not.
Individual elements, it's not that different.
Well,
the way it gets integrated and delivered is different.
That's what I'm saying. The integration, like, there is no – the way the mixing – I mean,
we just talked about the Queen track.
Right.
Okay. Imagine that the computer does the mix.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is that basically – was there going to be a moment in time where you'll be able to feed in – all your individual tracks and have the computer have complete control through your guidance of mixes. Even.
Well, that's what has to happen because let's say like sound effects. There's no way you can't pan at all because the user is the one who's panning. The user, as he moves around, if you're going to shoot me and I turn my back to you, now you're in the back. If I turn to front you, now you're in the center.
Hmm.
So all the panning is done by the computer and you've got like 100 different channels that can all be panned at the same time. If you start moving further away, I'm going to throw a low pass on there. So now all of a sudden the high ends. If you go behind a wall, I'm going to throw a reverb on it. Wow. If we're inside, we both have reverb on it.
Andrew, not only can you not mix in that, but the computers are actually taking your job away.
Yeah. Yes, well, I'm the one who very slowly will be singing "How Much Is That Doggy in the Wind" at the end of all this.
But you know what's interesting, though, is and this is my big platform within gaming, is they work with what they call a physics model, where when two things collide, it makes a sound. So whether you hit a trigger or a footsteps hit the ground, everything is based on collisions and physics collisions. The problem that you don't get in gaming is emotional arcs. So that's one of the things that I've been presenting at the Computer Game Developers Conference is the concept of emotional arcs. That is not being literal, but using sound in an artistic way to enhance an emotion. So then you've got to write an AI algorithm that defines, well, what is an emotion? Well, an emotion could be that I'm in a situation where I'm going to die. It really doesn't matter what I'm doing. So maybe I'm going to drop the sound effects, bring the music up, and have the dialogue pop some reverb on it.
Yeah, because if I'm going to die, I don't care what I'm listening to. You know. I just want to get the heck out of there. Well, hey, you know, that's you know, game audio is just so complex, and it's just on another level. And actually, it's kind of encouraging to hear that there's going to be a lot of opportunities for people, you know, who wanted to be Andrew but now can be Scott.
one thing I do love about gaming, you know, because obviously I do a lot of film. There are no rules in gaming. There is no, this is the way it's done.
Yeah.
And right now it's so Wild West where everyone is still figuring it out and doing guerrilla style that it's fun that you can get on the ground floor in an industry. It must have been where, you know, the first time a multi-track came out and where you didn't have to do it live straight to two-track. Everyone was like, well, how can we make this technology work for us? Yeah. It's the same thing. You've got a result that you want to come up with. And these are the tools to make it happen. How are you going to do it?
And the fundamentals, though, haven't changed. I mean, all the stuff that worked well in a studio when they did Bohemian Rhapsody still works well in
Absolutely.
The studio. Mic placement, you know, arranging, all that stuff. You still got to know the right way to do it, or at least some right ways to do it, and then make them your own.
I know several film guys that have left film and went into gaming.
Wow. I will tell you, Rob, well played. The whole segue from Bohemian Rhapsody to gaming?
Yeah.
That was like, that tied the whole thing
I
over there.
Well, no, I just may have a future as an integrator.
And you know what's interesting?
Or a podcast for you.
I went up to Electronic Arts up in the Bay Area, and talk about the difference in Hollywood. Hollywood is, you're lucky to have a job, shut up and work. Okay. EA is, they have a full-blown gym, full-blown theater. They have their own Starbucks. They've got several cafeterias. They've got bonus plans, health plans. They've got people that will cut your hair for you. I mean, it's a world. Theoretically, the concept is you never have to leave.
Wow. And they don't, because they work
outrageous
hours.
But it's the Silicon Valley business model. It's a very different business model than anything we've seen here. They have what they call campuses. And you work in these areas. And it's amazing. They're beautiful. Every building has a game room, everything from pinball to video games, and people are actually playing. They're playing tennis.
You know, that's a model that, you know, kind of became huge in the 90s, and they were all, you know, in Silicon Valley and Seattle
still
and
there.
Austin.
Yeah.
There were all these different places that got set up like that, you know, campuses. And after the high-tech, you know, meltdown, a lot of those places disappeared. But it's proven that if you have a huge young staff and you do all that stuff, they'll never go home and they'll just work 24/7. And it does work.
It does work.
Because we looked at it and said, it's college. This is a college.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they called a campus for a reason.
So no room for bitter old men. Hey, speaking of bitter old men, we're going to have to wrap it up.
No, you know what? There's usually a bitter old man in the accounting office.
Yeah, that's true.
The guy actually writing the checks for.
We're going to be wrapping this up, but yeah, that's fascinating. It's amazing how, you know, things don't really get created or destroyed. They just kind of move into different areas. And so the jobs that were in music are heading over to gaming, and then, you know, gaming's going to evolve and something else will come down
there. Is there, not to slow us down for a second here, but is there a problem with bootlegging of games? That's something I don't ever hear about. Are games
not yet? This concept of casual games are now starting to come out, which is kind of downloadable games that, you know, you can pay a buck for.
But are games hard to copy?
No, yeah,
they are.
And I mean, obviously they can be, but the console-based games are pretty hard to copy, and the computer-based ones, there are a few models that actually do work.
Well,
but that was one of the reasons why the 360 didn't have the hard drive on it, because people were like saying, hey, here's my hard drive, fill it up with games, and they were all bootlegged.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, yes, it's more difficult for certain games, but they're still bootlegs. I mean, I do know for a fact that the DS, I was reading online that the DS, they had this product, I think it's called like R4 or something like that. It's made by a Chinese manufacturer, and you can actually download games to this card that you stick into your DS and basically get any game you want.
PCs is huge bootleg.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of bootlegs out there that still, it's not as easy. You gotta, you know, jump through some hoops, but, you know, I think people will steal anything.
But the bad part about games, the economics of it, compared to TV, movies, and records. TV records, like Bohemian Rhapsody, has a life that keeps going. Once a game, look, if you had PlayStation 1 and you didn't modify that to PlayStation 2, it's dead.
Yeah.
It's gone.
We still play original Nintendo at my house all the time. And you know what? You know what's really funny about that? A lot of kids come over to visit with my kids or whatever. Like, man, you've got an original Nintendo. That's so cool. And they all want one. They all want one, which I don't know why.
I realize we're about to wrap up, but did you find the website for that artist I was talking about with the prices? Because I realize I was wrong with some of those prices.
Well, but. If you want to sing on her album, it's $10,000, not $100.
And what is her name?
But I do realize $10,000 to you is like $100.
Oh, so. Yeah, right. Yeah. No, but just make sure you give her name and her website because people should check it out. It's really funny.
Jill Sobule, and it's jillsnextrecord.com. And for $5,000, she'll come out and play a concert for you. It's actually pretty funny. If you read this whole thing, there's like
it's brilliant, 10 different levels. And it's working.
It's she got $62,000 last time I checked.
Wow.
So I think if people want this podcast to keep going, they should bring in $5
or some trail mix.
This is the last podcast.
Till next time.
Well, hey guys, we've run out of time, but it's been a pretty fascinating conversation. Hope I didn't depress too many people. Actually, I didn't depress anybody. It's all Andrew.
It's all my fault.
One thing we didn't get to talk about, and we'll have to talk about this next time, is talking about gear that we hate, because I had a really horrible, horrible experience with some gear.
And, we'll save that for next time.
Yes, we'll save that
my
for
Commodore
next time.
My Commodore 64.
But before we go, Rob, you working on anything you can talk about, you want to talk about?
Working on some actually game stuff, but the... One of the things I found, I haven't kind of gone after the game composer, I don't know what you'd call it. I haven't delved into that world because I'm working in different worlds. But my studio, we have actually done the recording for some games. And we're in the middle of doing one right now that I'm not allowed to talk about. But it's pretty cool to be basically creating elements in a way that's different for an album because it does all have to be able to be mixed on the fly. And we're doing a bunch of... recording for that and working on yes with Scott's folks and I never know what I'm allowed to talk about.
That's so about just, all you can say.
That's about it. But we're also working on some other things that I can't announce yet, but it's coming soon.
It's coming. We'll be waiting. Andrew,
I won't say what it's for, but with all of the doom and gloom, I actually spent the last 2 days recording strings and horns on a record, 12 songs in 2 days with a bunch of live musicians, and it was great.
No, you just think you did. So if you go back and check, you probably did.
Yeah, maybe I did. No, but so that was good actually being in a studio with lots of musicians and lots of microphones and hitting record and people playing stuff.
And those tracks have already hit the internet and you can remix them.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds great actually. I would have loved to have been there.
Scott, I know you finished your films that you were working on.
Yeah, I can finally talk about stuff now. I finished a movie called Express. It might come out, we're thinking about October. I think it might be up there with one of the best things I've ever done. I'm quite excited about it. We were lucky enough to get the time we needed to do it right, which is a massive rarity in this day of age. So I'm excited, it's like a bunch of kids coming out of camp, so we're all sad that, we have to leave and now go back to school. But it was a wonderful experience, and now I can actually even say there's two games and a movie I'm working on. Right now I've just finished half of the weapons for Gears of War 2.
Wow!
So we've put it in the game, and we're gonna see how it plays, and then finish it up.
That's
also
awesome.
We're just starting Fable 2.
Wow!
So I could and that's
triple A titles,
and then
those are big titles.
And then the other thing I'm doing, which is for fun, is I've just been awarded. I'm gonna do all the creatures for the Mummy. That's coming up for Universal, I think, this summer. So I get to –
The Mummy movie?
The Mummy movie. I get to do
really?
Dragons and all these kinds of stuff.
Give us a little preview of a dragon.
Roar.
I'm going to listen for that.
It sounds different with reverb.
Yeah, so it's guns and swords and then I get to do dragons. So
that's awesome. That's great.
So it's fun. This week I'm taking a little bit of a rest and then I start everything on Monday.
So I guess you really do know what you were talking about then, about the whole game thing.
I've done a couple.
You've done a couple.
Like two.
High-end titles. well, that's great. I finished the documentary and,
Woo-hoo.
And it was,
Anthony Hopp.
It was an experience, but I will tell you that I don't think my monitors were calibrated properly, so I'm going to take my mix over to my good friend Rob's studio, and I know his monitors are calibrated. But it really, you know, but the one lesson that I will tell you is, you know, it doesn't hurt to, once you finish a mix, to pull it out and see if you can play it in a couple other different places, you know?
I was worried you were going to say, when you finish the mix, bring it to Rob's house.
Well, you know, there's little tweaky things that have to be done, but, and the mix may very well be fine, but if you have any doubts, you know, you want to check it. You want to check it on different speakers. Well, you want to check it in different environments and, you know, being this one's 5-1, you know, I want to check it in another studio and just make sure that, you know, it's all there. It's exactly where you want it to be, and nothing funny and nothing weird. No.
Well, bring it to the studio and I'll try to find time to to meet you there.
That's right. Yeah, you said I can bring it over. You didn't say I can play it.
Yeah, exactly. No, but feel free to bring it over. There's a driveway.
All right. Well, hey, listen, if you have any comments or questions, or you want to write us and tell us any stories about gear that you hate, because we are going to be talking about that.
We have at least one listener that hates the Yamaha mixer that he never got.
Oh, no, he should appreciate that he never got.
All right. Right. If he got it, he would hate it. All right.
All right. You can send us an email to audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And you can also visit us in our MySpace. It's myspace.com/audionowcast. All right. From myself and all the guys, thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time. And hopefully Scott and Andrew will be with us for the next podcast too.
Yeah, come on, guys.
Especially Andrew. Wow, you wind him up. Man, he just goes.
Oh, no, wind him up and watch him go.
clap on.
Remember that button.
But I don't know. He's pretty busy for a guy in an industry that doesn't have any work.
And he's smiling now. So we'll see you guys next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel voice processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.